Lend me your ears. The Oral Dramaturgies Podcast. The Salon. Conversations about sound.
Hello, welcome to The Salon. Today we host three interlocutors, all of whom are affiliated to and partly responsible for the vibrant research culture of performance studies at the University of Sydney. Gay McCauley lectured on theatre and film in French before co-founding performance studies as an interdisciplinary centre at the University of Sydney in 1989. Throughout the 1970s and 80s, she worked to establish modes of collaboration between academics and theatre practitioners, and in the 1990s she pioneered the application of ethnographic methodologies to the study of rehearsal processes. She is the author of the pivotal award-winning volume Space in Performance and Not Magic But Work in 2012. Since retiring in 2002, she has continued to contribute to the field and is currently based in London. Paul Dwyer returned to university in the mid-1990s after almost a decade of professional theatre work, mostly as an actor, animateur, director or dramaturg in the field of youth and community theatre. Moving from an interest in Boal's Theatre of the Oppressed, his research has examined the notion of reconciliation in social performance, from analysis of protest actions through to studies of village-based ritual reconciliation ceremonies in Papua New Guinea. Paul has a strong track record of developing creative practices research through his involvement with professional theatre companies such as Version 1.0 and Belvoir Street Theatre, and has co-devised a number of critically acclaimed documentary theatre pieces. Laura Ginters lectures in the Department of Performance Studies at the University of Sydney. She has a background in Germanic studies, and her early research examined female characters in and female actors and directors' interpretations of Georg Büchner's Danton's Death. Laura has worked at Playworks, the National Women's Performance Writers Network, was Associate Director of the International Theatre Institute, and has also worked for Opera Australia. She translates for the stage and works as a dramaturg and has had articles published locally and internationally in the areas of writing for performance, historical and contemporary rehearsal, feminism and theatre, translation, performance analysis and Indigenous theatre. In this conversation, Laura Gay and Paul discuss the Australian theatre and research scene vis-à-vis uses of speech and sound in performance, thinking through dramaturgy, ethnography, and rehearsal as interrelated practices, methods, and spaces of exploratory orality. They reflect together on the beginnings of the Sydney approach to studying rehearsal and comment on how that framework has been extended beyond Western practices, supplying numerous fascinating examples of contemporary artists working with sound, space, amplification, and radio. This Salon conversation was recorded on the 10th of July 2020 on Zoom between Sydney and London.
Okay, well, so here we are. So hello, you two.
Hello.
We used to say okay. This conversation be taking place across time zones and continents. And here it's 8 in the morning, so that's really quite uncivilized. And there, back there, it's 5 o'clock or 5:30 and have a nice cup of tea, I see. So our conversation is going to be basically about the methodologies that we've developed and the procedures that we've developed in Sydney for documenting and observing rehearsal process, the creative process in theatre performance of all sorts that we've been doing for quite a long time now. And you guys are the second generation of scholars who've been engaged in this work. So we're going to take a historical look at it. We're going to look at the genesis of the work. But for the moment, let me just throw over to Laura, who's going to actually introduce an example of the kind of documentation that we've been interested in doing.
Thanks, Gay, and it's lovely to be with you and Paul today. I would like to introduce the work of Theatre Cantanka and their project, The Obscene Madam D. We thought it would be good to top and tail this salon with some work done by practitioners here in Australia, and to open with a company who have had a long connection with the Centre for Theatre and Performance Studies, Department of Theatre and Performance Studies now. Theatre Cantanka have worked with us for probably 20 years now, and this is the most recent project that they did with us. It was the major project for our third year rehearsal studies students. We'll talk more about that core unit in a little while. And it was developed in the Rex Cramphorn studio, our studio space where artists work year round. They rehearsed and developed their piece in front of a group of third year students. And that was in 2016, in the middle of 2016. And the show was then further developed and went on to a public season in April 2018. And we have a lovely clip of that work for you here.
Instead of these luxurious thoughts, could you make me a coffee?
Palpated, running his fingers across my hips,
my thighs,
pressing his mouth against the hairs at the most intimate of me, Ehud's lips hard opening. Supple, humid, barely had he touched you. Listen.
I said, listen.
Wait. I want so much to speak with you. No, Ehud. Not now, please.
No, Ehud, no. Not now, please.
I want to speak to you of the multiple nothings of the day to day which go consuming the best part of us. I want to speak to you of the burden when old age comes. Of the disappearance. Of that thing which doesn't exist but is raw. Alive. Time.
It was quite a stunning showing of the work in development. The audience was placed throughout the space, so it was a very immersive kind of experience to be part of that showing. The performer was Katia Molino, who's a very accomplished contemporary performance artist who has worked over 20 or more years in the contemporary performance scene in Australia. It was a real tour de force of performance for her. And we picked this particular performance as a really lovely example, we thought, of Dushka's notion of oral and aural dramaturgies, because you have this wonderfully intense experience where the audience is all sitting in their own headphones, but enjoying this very intimate connection to the performer who they see in front of them, weaving between them. So sometimes in front of them, sometimes behind them. It's that paradoxical thing with headphones that, despite the fact you're separated from a live performer in front of you, you are also very strongly connected to them. And while you lose that wonderful sense that you get in live theatre of your bodies being connected between the performer's voice and your ears, this kind of headphone theatre gives you a completely different experience of that shared intimacy with the performer. And it was quite a magical performance, though I must say that the workshop performance where the audience was scattered amongst the set and the performer worked even better than when it went to a formal theatre setting where we were sat in two rows and the performer performed in more conventionally in the middle of that space.
Can I ask, so that recording was made in the Rex studio?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Fascinating, gorgeous, lovely work. the audience are wearing headphones.
Mm.
Their relation to the performer is changed, as Laura's just been saying, that there's this kind of intimate connection. What about their relation to the rest of the audience? What happens? Are they cut off from the rest of the audience in some way?
I think that's a really interesting question, Gay, because for me, this sort of headphone theatre, and in this case, it's the audience rather than the performer who's wearing the headphones, is closer in many ways to radio drama, despite the fact we're there live with her, because we experience it in a very solitary kind of way. And although it has connections to live performance, in other ways, it's much more akin to the experience of radio drama, I think, than live performance. And in that way, in the way that in radio drama, you as an individual are connected to the sound, but not to any other audience, even though you might be sharing the airwaves with thousands of other people. I find that in a performance like that one, and particularly in the more conventional setting, I did feel quite disconnected from the other audience members. And it was quite unsettling to not have that experience of being part of that body of people breathing together and experiencing together.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe something's lost, but something's gained as well. I mean, I always think of our colleague Lowell Lewis, the anthropologist who talked about sound, you know, of the senses, sound is in some ways the most public and also the most intimate, because obviously from a phenomenological point of view, it literally gets into your body and resonates in your ear canal and so forth. So there's something, there is an enormous intimacy. I don't completely lose consciousness of the other audience members. I feel like I'm having an experience in parallel with them, but it might not be the same experience. It reminds me of Brecht, one of his famous poems. He talks about when the actor speaks their words, I think the phrase goes something like, the actor speaks their words as if it was an arrow going out into the audience. And he says something like, I know that we're hearing the same thing, but we're not hearing it at the same time, or we're not perfectly in sync. And I actually really enjoy that sense of phasing, being kind of in phase and out of phase the performer and with my fellow audience members. But
yes, I should say, I guess that I'm a huge fan of radio drama. I love radio drama as a form. Mm. And we've talked about this a little over the last few days, this fascinating thing that, you know, radio drama was such an incredibly important form in the early part of the 20th century. And then 20 years ago, 15 years ago, it started waning in terms of the support that it got through our national broadcaster and so on. Mm. And that happened at the same time as podcasting just started and people started to experience this kind of oral and oral dramaturgy and communication in new ways. So I don't think it's a negative thing. I really treasure that extraordinary experience that you can get through radio drama and through a performance like Cartier's in Obscene Madam D. Mm.
Mm. Can I ask now about the experience of the creative process and what you documented and what you recorded? So were you documenting Cartier's creative process, basically? Where were the students involved in this? Where were the watchers? And what was happening with the sound, the creation of the sound? Did you record all that?
So this was a project that was supervised by our colleague Amanda Card. So I wasn't in the room for the whole of the process, but yes, it was actually recorded. Students, following your excellent training, Gay, wrote a logbook which documented what went on in the course of the rehearsal and the development process, and it was recorded. But I think that much of the development went on not in the dim lighting of the final workshop version, but the students were certainly an integral part of it and were placed within the space during the course of the rehearsal process. So they weren't sitting off not to be observed and not to interfere with the process. They were folded into it.
So they were actually props.
Yes, they were.
In a way.
Yes.
For an installation. Yes.
So the making of the sound and the making of the video, were the issues involved for you in documenting all that? Were there complications? Because so much of that making the sound tape,
or the, it's happening the, on people's laptops and stuff.
Yeah,
that happens. And also the artists were able to use some of the facilities elsewhere on campus, on the campus of Sydney University. sound recording studios and so forth. But I, you touched on a really good point, Gay. I mean, I know we're going to go back and talk about the early development of rehearsal studies at Sydney Uni, but it is true that when you are trying to observe and document the process of artists who are exploring new technologies and who are kind of working at the, yeah, I guess the kind of the really complex interface of technologies that favour secondary orality, of which there's such a proliferation now, and residual technologies that come to us from literacy, you know, a text or documents or whatever, it becomes a bit harder, you know, because there are these moments where a lot of these contemporary performance companies, their rehearsal doesn't look like a conventional play script based rehearsal. You might have half a dozen people or more strewn across the space, all working on their own laptops. And so for students, observers of the rehearsal process, it can be a little bit tricky, you know, how much are you allowed to interact with that artist who seems to be doing something quite private and isn't necessarily talking everything through in the way a play script-based rehearsal tends to involve a lot of table work and then often a fairly structured move from the table work to the work on the floor and so forth. It's a movable feast in my experience. But I guess I would also come back to the thing that any kind of mode of rehearsal documentation and analysis that draws inspiration from ethnographic methods, the practical challenges of doing the field work are actually telling you something about the nature of the process itself. You know, when we've had students, for example, who've wanted to do an ethnographically inflected or an ethnographically inspired study of, say, theatre design processes. Well, you know, most theatre designers working in independent theatre are doing the work in their bedrooms or in their... the difficulty of getting access is telling you something about the precarious situation of those artists, which is an important part of the analysis of the field before you even get to, you know, the discussions of the showing of practice. But I wonder, Gay and Laura, should we maybe wind back the clock a little bit and talk about how the Department of Theatre and Performance Studies at Sydney Uni embarked on this decades-long adventure now of kind of taking a quasi-ethnographic approach to studying the creative process of theatre practitioners?
Storytelling, but
you should, and I think you should start, Gay. Like, because when the department was, my sense, and Laura and I are basically from the same vintage, we were undergraduate students with you and then postgraduate students with you. My sense was that certainly in the early 80s, mid 80s, you know, it was the high point of semiotic approaches to analysing live performance, and that the rehearsal studies stuff was kind of working backwards from that, you know, to try and understand. The process of semiosis and decisions about blocking and staging of various sort were made. And then it became its own beast. Can you elaborate a bit on that?
So what happened was, first of all, because when I was working in the French department, that's the other thing about performance studies at Sydney, is that the people who set it up were all from different language departments. So Indonesian and Italian and French and English. So working with literature students, so my intention was to demonstrate to them how meaning is made in the theatre, how the text functions in the theatre process, that the meaning that is made in the theatre is made with the text, it's not in the text. And that's why I wanted to get actors to come to the university and rehearse in front of the students so that they would see how this process, this creative process worked. That's how it began. And as you say, it was the heyday of semiotics. So our intention was to find ways of analysing performance, of dealing with performance, instead of forever the performance being subordinated to the text and to literary study of the text. So that was the rationale. And the reason we wanted actors, highly skilled professional actors, not the students doing it themselves in workshops, which was the way drama departments operated, because I knew that we wouldn't get far enough with that. We needed to have real actors, really highly skilled actors, who were going to mine the text and do the thing that actors do when they read and explore text. So, and then when performance studies started, when we got the funding and were able to start performance studies, we kept working with professional artists because we'd realised how extremely valuable this was. So we were doing various projects at that stage. When we started, we were doing whole productions. We got the funding, don't ask how, but we did, to do whole productions. And then we realised that, A, that was too expensive. We couldn't get funding every year, but we had students every year. So that was part of the reason for starting the documentation. So all these things were happening simultaneously. We were exploring performance analysis, documentation of performance, and recording performance. So we had these full productions, and we realised that was too much. That was, and that may spill over into what you're going to say about the issues that you're confronting now, but it was too much for the students. They couldn't afford the time to spend 6 weeks watching. We couldn't afford the money. And also, my experience was that it produced too much material for me to cope with in a year. And so that's another thing that the model that the drama departments, the theatre studies departments were working on was continually to produce more and more work. So every year they were producing plays with the students. The students would be doing workshops and making theatre. And so they were becoming kind of pseudo practitioners in that they just were always on to the next thing and never having the chance to think back and look over what had been done and deal with the material they produced. So that was where we were. And this was when the ethnographic turn happened, I suppose, that we're finding we had masses of material that was coming in through this work. And the theatre studies colleagues were not at all interested in this work, I have to say. They were actually very critical of it. When I gave papers at theatre studies conferences, they said things like, but how boring to sit and watch for all that time. You really mean you sit and watch? Don't you want to be doing it yourself? And I would say, no, not at all. And A, it's not boring. Others said, oh, but that's parasitic on the actors. For some reason, academics are supposed to miraculously have these insights themselves and not rely on the actors. And other people, because this, the other thing that was happening at this time was, of course, that huge divide between what now, with after Hans Thies Lehmann, we would say dramatic theatre and post-dramatic theatre. But at that time, there was this huge polemic within the theatre community about dramatic theatre, text-based, character-based, narrative-based theatre, which was considered old hat and boring. And why were we, so other colleagues in theatre studies departments were saying, why were we focusing on Corneille and Racine and Strindberg and Büchner? Those were the productions that we had done when we should have been working with contemporary performance. And as you know, we did a lot of that work as well. So this was where we were at, realizing there was something hugely important that we were trying to grasp and not having the methods to do so, not knowing how to cope. And then you've heard this story before, but our Indonesianist friend, colleague, Tony Day, had invited an anthropologist to come to the department to seminar to talk about her experience in Bali. She was had been doing an ethnographic study of faith healing, been going
this
back
was
to Bali.
Linda Connor?
Linda Connor, who's now the professor of anthropology.
Anthropology, that's right.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
And a good union member, by the way.
Oh, bless her. Well, she was a lecturer at Newcastle University at the time. So she had been going back to Indonesia, working with this faith healer, and she had organised for an ethnographic filmmaker to come and film a session of faith healing. So her paper was about the issues of documentation, because as I said, we were really involved with documentation at the time. How do you document performance? How can you record performance? Can you document the rehearsal process? How do you do it? Do you make a film or do you write about it? Do you write case books or do you make films? She was talking about the problems of conflict between, or this triangular relationship between herself, the anthropologist, the faith healer, her host, as she called her, and the filmmaker. And there were all sorts of issues there with the technology intervening in the faith healing process. And then she was talking about her sense of the problems of her relationship with her host in the field, the field work experience, entering the field. She talked about the conflicts that she sensed when her host would only tell her what she thought was appropriate for her to know, or other occasions when the host would be telling her what the host thought she wanted to know rather than what was really happening. She talked about all these issues that just resonated with me. There it is. She gets it. She knows exactly that these are the issues that we're confronting all the time. How to gain access, how to relate. So I realized that ethnography and the experience of ethnographers in the field was where we were going to find the sorts of guidance, the sorts of conceptual framework, the sorts of methodologies perhaps that were going to help us to do this work. And that's where it all began. And the other thing that I learned from Linda Connor was about time. Because her experience, the anthropological, the ethnographic experience, was this immersion in the field and then withdrawal from the field and then years of work on the material that's been gathered. So the editing of the film, she was saying the film wasn't going to be ready for years down the track. And then the use of the ethnographic film. How does it, is it standalone? Is it actually used in a context of some discussion, of some presentation by the anthropologist? Does it illustrate points, or is it in itself a complete record? That was also extremely important for us, for me. I thought that those are the issues. Okay, we don't have to keep on producing more work, more work, more work. We actually have to give ourselves the time now to do a project and then work on it. So that's how it happened. That's how it began.
I think the phrase that is popular in academia these days is slow scholarship. And I think Laura and I, and I'm sure others listening, and Dushka and co, would agree that it would be nice to be in institutions that supported a little bit more the idea of slow scholarship. Gay and Laura, if you don't mind, can I just be a bit cheeky here? Gay, I want to quote back to you something that you wrote in an article in 1996. Because I'm thinking it might be worth thinking about, you know, what was learned once the department, the researchers in the department had started to make this turn towards an ethnographic paradigm for analysing creative process. What are some of the things that were learned? And you wrote in 1996, very beautifully, you said, "Theatre, as I have come more and more to appreciate, the more I observe the rehearsal process, is a profoundly oral practice. And it needs to be explored within an oral paradigm." And you wrote that, you know, with kind of equal relevance to text-based, play script-based theatre and more contemporary performance modes. I just wonder whether you want to elaborate a little bit on that, because it strikes me as something still very true. And I imagine Laura would, teaching rehearsal studies, you would have had many moments, those pin drop moments when you realise it doesn't matter if the words are written by some famous playwright and are fixed in stone, this is an oral practice. But look, maybe first you, Gay, and then Laura, if you want to talk a little bit more about that.
Yes. Well, our experience, of course, was that there was a lot of talk in rehearsal. It was always that everything was talked about. So now what you're saying that might be happening now with technology is there may be less talk. The creator is sitting at the computer doing
stuff, not talking it through. Differently structured talk, I think, for me anyway, but Laura might have some views about that.
So that was definitely the experience of the practice. But it was, I was going in that article, I think I'm talking about orality and literacy and that theatre being the first artistic form that was written down, that it came out of an oral culture, but the text was written. And then I think Aristotle put us on the wrong track from the very beginning by saying that what mattered was the written.
But he wasn't observing rehearsals and was about 150 years after the performance.
So we've been it seemed to me that the university as an institution, fair and square in the literate domain, was never going to be able to deal with theatre, which was an oral practice.
Yes.
It was always going to be this conflict. And what theatre studies departments were doing was kind of shifting themselves somehow into the oral domain by making performance and not writing about it. And theatre practitioners had been making performance but not theorising their work until the rise of the director, when directors did start writing. And now we've got, through the 20th century, a whole literature of theorising the practice, beginning to theorise the practice. Until then, as we know from our experience in rehearsal, that actors, the knowledge, this craft knowledge, is not written down, it's passed on orally in rehearsal. But as Jim Sharman said in his brilliant aside in that Rex Cramphorn lecture, that it's passed on as gossip. Right, there's storytelling, it's anecdotes and storytelling. And that was one of the things that we did discover by sitting patiently in the rehearsal rooms, that we were able to see how this process of passing on knowledge happens in an oral practice.
Yeah.
In that article, I also talk about theatre practice being at the interface of emergent and residual cultures. And it did seem to me that that's something also really important about mainstream theatre practice. That article is also coming at this, at the time of this dispute between the mainstream, is as Schechner was dismissing it as boring, and bourgeois and dead, and the contemporary theatre practice, the experimental, the avant-garde, and I was trying to say that what is valuable about our Western mainstream theatre culture that we've had for 2,000 years is that it does always involve this derided text-based practice. It involves an engagement between residual culture, the text, and emergent, the oral, the contemporary, the here and now. The residual has to be made anew in the present. And engage with the context of the present. And that's something extremely valuable that we were at risk of throwing overboard, it seemed.
What about you, Laura, from teaching students a Macaulay-esque, if I can put it that way, approach to rehearsal studies? What do you feel you've been learning yourself along the way about rehearsal and this kind of oral culture that exists, a residual oral culture or a secondary oral culture that exists within rehearsal rooms?
Look, I had made that note to myself about Gay commenting about theatre rehearsal being an oral practice. So it's something that I've certainly carried with me when I think about teaching rehearsal studies, indeed teaching dramaturgy as well, because I think that there are, for me, really strong connections in the way that I teach a course on dramaturgy to third year students that emerge directly out of my experience of observing professional actors in rehearsal projects for rehearsal studies. And I think you can't underestimate that. And when I think about this idea of oral and oral dramaturgy, it takes me back to the very first National Playwrights Conference I attended as a dramaturg. And I had been given several plays to work on that were to be developed in this conference. And, you know, I'd done my preparation, and as you know, I came out of literature department, so I'd done a lot of work with text-based theatre, but as a text. And I'd done all my preparation. I'd worked so hard to think about how we might develop these works. And then the second we sat down with actors and I started hearing those words coming out of the mouths of actors, I instantly started making connections that I had not seen while reading and understanding how the play worked in ways that I could not possibly have understood just by reading. And I think that that's something really powerful about sound and orality. It untethers you from that linearity of scripts, and it's a real gift because that's what actors can give you in a rehearsal room too, that they're that mediator between that written text and what it can actually mean. And that's something that I've taken on board when I teach dramaturgy. So the courses I teach it now is always based around a project where we invite in a director, a dramaturg, a writer, and actors to work on a new piece, a new play or piece of performance. and the students are, even in that dramaturgy course, quasi-ethnographers. They're learning dramaturgical skills, but what they're doing is sitting and observing these professionals at work. And their task, their assessment task, is to start with the text before it went into a dramaturgical workshop. And at the end of that workshop, tell me about the dramaturgy that went on. What does dramaturgy entail? And it's not just cutting and pasting a text, and it's not just the writer who does it, and it's not just the dramaturg either. It's often the actors who are the people who have the skills to develop that text into something that will become theatre.
I'm really interested to hear you talk about that, Laura, that there's that carryover from teaching the ethnographic approach to rehearsal studies to the way that you think about dramaturgy. Certainly for me, and when I wear that other hat that I wear a little bit beyond the walls of academia, when I've been making professional theatre, principally verbatim and documentary theatre, normally as the dramaturg, researcher type of person, occasionally as a performer, fairly reluctantly as a performer, I must admit, I've been thinking about this salon and reflecting on how much my practice as a theatre maker in that documentary area has been informed by the rehearsal ethnography work that Gay started. And partly I think it's because, and this is one of the things I really like about Dushka's notion of oral dramaturgies, is that it reorients the discussion of, say, verbatim theatre slightly away, not totally away from politics, but comes at it from a different angle. Because I think, for me, when I've been making verbatim and documentary theatre work, it's never just been about, you know, in a world of political spin, we must speak truth to power. Mm. It was always about attending to the texture of talk. And I think when, you know, the more I got into reading about ethnographic research methods or other qualitative research methods like conversation analysis or systemic functional linguistics or grounded theory or whatever, but particularly the ethnographers, I had that sense that verbatim theatre involves, in a similar way, a commitment to vernacular experience. I also had that sense that, you know, you have to attend to the texture of the talk as much as anything else. There's just as much information to be gleaned from the manner in which an interviewee is speaking to you, their pauses and hesitations and false starts and all of that, as there is from the ideational content of their talk. So that is something that really appeals. But the other thing is some of the theatre works that I've made, so the Bougainville Photoplay Project, based on the research I did up in Papua New Guinea, and Beautiful One Day, based on work with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples on Palm Island in the far north of Queensland. Those were documentary theatre projects in which I was entering into cultures where there's really still a very strong residual orality, huge. I think it was when I was in those cultures and I started thinking back about all of the curriculum materials that we share with our students in rehearsal studies, I suddenly went, oh, now I understand what Clifford Geertz means when he's talking about thick description, or now I understand what Kirsten Hastrup means when she talks about the risks of symbolic violence. It's full on. And I think all the ethnographic literature started to make a lot more sense for me. But also because I had some of that ethnographic methodology on board, it started to change the way I negotiated relationships with people in those cultural settings and went about making a piece of theatre. I guess what I wanted to say was there's a difference for me of degree. I wouldn't say a difference in kind, but I think there's a difference in degree between doing observations of theatre practitioners in a rehearsal studio as a form of field work, and then, you know, working in the sorts of settings that anthropologists have traditionally, problematically, base themselves in.
And yes.
I was saying to Laura earlier, it's for example, it's that sense that when you're in a place like Palm Island or the region of Bougainville in Papua New Guinea, there's no pause button. There's no, you can never get away from the rehearsal. You can never say, okay, that's the end of today's rehearsal, I'll go home and have dinner. It's just, you're constantly on.
Yes.
And there's a much greater ambiguity about the roles that people are playing. You know, it can take you months or even years to start to understand the family histories and the clan ties and the economic relationships between people which contribute to an individual status. And I know that, you know, roles can be slippery in a theatre rehearsal room too. Like, if, for example, the dramaturg, you know, everyone can have a hand in dramaturgy. It's not just the person who's designate as a dramaturg, but I think it's even more intense in those kind of traditional, quote unquote, fieldwork settings.
Absolutely.
And also that difficulty of bracketing off what's going to turn out to be important in your research. So, a whole morning spent talking with someone in Papua New Guinea about the process of smoking coconut shells and then bagging the stuff up to be processed as a copra, cash crop. And you think, well, what's this got to do with my ethnographic fieldwork research into reconciliation ceremonies? But of course it has everything to do with it, because it's about how people make the money that they need to stage a reconciliation ceremony. So I think that those are sort of things that I would have been completely out of my depth if I hadn't had some grounding in ethnography through the study of theatrical rehearsal processes. But it also led me to understand at a much deeper level the ethnographic methodology, I think. And it changed the way, for example, just making a piece of documentary theatre work with Aboriginal people, particularly obviously as a white middle class male, it's not just about, finding stories. It's about making sure that you have the permission to tell those stories. So, for example, in the show Beautiful One Day, which I know Laura and you both saw, we were talking to the granddaughter of a very famous Aboriginal activist, Willie Thaiday. And this woman, Kylie, was a performer in our show, Kylie Dumaji. And we'd edited the whole creative team, we'd edited some bits of her grandfather's autobiography, beautiful text about where he's kind of denouncing the colonial control of Aboriginal people's lives on Palm Island. And we said, here you go, Kylie, this would make a great monologue for you. And it's your granddad after all. And she's rehearsing it. And it's a text that I thought, this will sit perfectly with her. The text had a very oral style, even though it had been written down, it had obviously been taken from speech. And she was rehearsing and she came to me after a couple of hours. She said, Paul, I don't think I can do this. And I thought it was just a performer confidence issue. And I said, of course you can, Kylie, you'll be fine. You've got a great presence on stage. I'll help you learn your lines. Come on, let's have a look at it. And it took me quite a while before I realized she meant, I don't think I can do it. I certainly can't do it unless we go around and we talk with all of the aunties and uncles who have a living connection to my grandfather, Willie Thaiday, because I don't know if I can stand on stage as a young woman and voice the words of my grandfather, who was a senior male elder in the community. Thank God I had a smidgen of ethnographic fieldwork methodology. So it's kind of one of the unexpected spin-offs for me of the way in which we've set about studying theatre makers' creative processes. It took me a while to realise it was informing the way I was going about making work beyond the academy. Mm.
That's a very revealing story. I'm delighted to hear that, actually. Because, of course, that was one of the major impacts of our turn, of the ethnographic turn, was to take us out of the laboratory, out of the studio, out of the Rex Cramphorn studio, and into the theatre to actually try and engage with what was going on the practitioner's own terms, even though that made it much harder because they didn't want us there often, and we had to coax and cajole to be permitted that degree of access. Mm. You can study all kinds of things in the laboratory. And I think a lot of the work that is very interesting work that's going on in Europe now, where university academic groups are getting into very interested in creative process, they're tending to do it in the laboratory, kind of dipping in. We've got a week, they're giving us a week of access to their work, and we'll go and watch for a week. My experience is against this slow research. 1 week is not enough. You need to be there for the whole thing.
Yes, that's so true. And it makes me envious of our honours students, actually, Gay, because of course each year we still send our honours students out to do a full length placement on of theatre or performance making process. And we have had some really extraordinary pieces of work that have come out of that. A number of them from mainstream theatre companies. So I can think of a wonderful project that was at Belfast Street Theatre a couple of years ago. And we had two students last year, one at attached to Griffin on A New Australian Work, Hilary, one of Hilary Bell's plays, and another working on an STC show. But there are also those other marvellous projects where these students take the training that they've had in the recs, so in our laboratory, and then they apply it to somewhere completely unexpected. Mm. So we had an absolutely outstanding honours casebook last year, which looked at roller derby training. And this particular student was both a participant and an observer. So she trained with this team and then wrote about them. And it was fascinating. And another casebook recently was with a student who attended a music festival. So, yeah, a camp out, take lots of drugs, get very dirty kind of music festival.
Not our student.
No, because she was being an observer.
No names, but, no pack drill.
No, absolutely not. But absolutely fascinating that you can take this kind of training and the this kind of theory and you can use it in all sorts of other situations where people are undergoing undergoing training or performing in some way.
I wanted to say something to Paul. I noticed, Paul, that you're saying very correctly that this is ethnographically inflected work. Yeah. And I think that's really important, that we are not doing ethnography, we're doing performance studies.
Yes.
But we are
it's a sliding scale
from ethnography.
Yeah.
And their practices and their experiences to help us do what we're trying to do, which is engage with these whole vast range of performance practices in the context of various societies. So it's true, it's a sliding. I can see that from what your experience, Paul, on Palm Island could be seen as ethnography.
Yeah, I think it's a sliding scale. I think for our undergraduate students, they get a little window onto rehearsal. If they do a fourth year honours research project, it becomes quite substantial. And then some of the postgraduate students at PhD level are doing really, I don't have a problem saying they're doing an ethnographic study of X, Y or Z. You described the ethnographic turn that our department took, you know, I guess 3 decades ago. And it was kind of small steps and a lot of kind of, oh my gosh, are we becoming anthropologists now? Maybe a little bit, hopefully. And now, of course, everyone's jumping on the bandwagon. So there's, you know, all sorts of disciplines who are claiming that their research is ethnography, and sometimes they haven't paid their dues, quite frankly. But by the same token, I would say I think it's a strength in our discipline that we do let students at an undergraduate level start to dip their toes into the waters of ethnography. I think for years in anthropology, the discipline was probably held back because they still had the idea of the heroic field worker. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't let their students go anywhere near actually doing ethnographic style research until they'd done an honours degree and you had to go. Wait, that was all left until you were a postgraduate student. You had to have done 2 years of fieldwork before you could contemplate beginning to write your thesis and so forth. You know, it's useful to start introducing students to ethnographic ways of researching much earlier, because it foregrounds all of these other important questions of embodiment, or questions, as Dushka's asking, you know, to do with the rapidly changing technological environment in which performance is made. And, you know, we are in an era now where Walter Ong talked about secondary orality, and I think he had in mind, you know, the tape recorder. And, you know, and now, you know, there are so many technologies now that facilitate forms of secondary orality. And I think going right back to your original comments about performance being, theatre being an oral paradigm or operating within an oral culture, anytime you've got a rapid expansion of technologies that promote new forms of orality or orality, and you've still got obviously the strong literacy in our culture, you do get interesting things happening in performance out of that. But I think Tim Fitzpatrick, in another context, talking about Come dell'arte, talked about there's always a generative structural tension between cultural forms that come to us from the world of literacy and cultural forms that come to us through oral traditions, and performance is often operating with that structural tension.
So maybe, Paul, now is the time to talk about some of the Australian practitioners.
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree with Laura that that show by Theatre Kantanka that we looked at the start is a fantastic example of what could be thought of as a work made within an oral dramaturgical frame. The two practitioners, for those who may be listening, two practitioners from Australia whose work I would really encourage people to look at, one is Rosalind Oades, O-A-D-E-S, and just Google her and she'll come up. She's a Melbourne-based theatre maker. She's a really sophisticated theatre maker in the area of headphone verbatim practice. And what I love about her work is that she's often casting people with scant regard to age, gender, ethnicity, and so forth. Her performers always wear really big, boofy headphones, so not simple little earpieces. So there's no ambiguity that the person who is talking to you may not be the person who spoke those original words in interviews. So there's a really kind of strong Brechtian element in her work, and the performances are kind of halfway between spirit possession and just a kind of task-based performance aesthetic. I love her work. But the other artist who I would mention in connection with oral dramaturgies is a woman by the name of Tamara Saulwick, who's also Melbourne-based. I think her partner is a composer, actually. And so she's always worked a lot with sound in her live performance work. About 5 years ago, a decade ago, she made a work called Pin Drop that was very, very well received. It was almost like she's always mixing old technologies and new technologies. Pin Drop was almost like a Foley sound studio thing. So she had, you know, a microphone and a little table and all of these little objects with which she could make sounds. Mm-hmm. But she also had these recordings of interviews with people describing moments of fear and anxiety in their lives. And some of these stories were, of course, stories from women about the fear and stress that they live under, sometimes even in their own homes, you know, difficult situations. And the sound score, you know, the smallest little sounds were amplified. You know, if she's tearing a piece of paper and it's amplified in the space, you know, this sort of thing. An extraordinary work. And then more recently, this I think work premiered in 2015, a work called Endings, which was commissioned for the Sydney Festival in 2015 and has since toured to the UK. I think it was at the Brighton Festival, Dublin Festival, and Vancouver, I think the Push International Festival of the Arts in Vancouver. And Endings, she describes it as a meditation on cycles and the ending of things, using portable turntables, reel-to-reel tape players, and live performance. Endings finds form for experiences both ordinary and extraordinary that cluster around death, dying, and afterlife. So she recorded, I think, about a dozen interviews, and then she put those recordings onto old technologies like pressed records, antique record players are placed all over the space, and reel-to-reel tape machines with the tape running over meters. And she's also performing live, and there's music and so forth. There's this fragility to the voice because there are people talking about not necessarily unhappy experiences towards the end of a life, you know, attending someone who's working their way towards death, I suppose. But the fragility of it all is reinforced by the use of the old technology. So by your leave, I might take control of the screen again and just play a little bit of because she remade the work as a radio play. So this is, but bear in mind that it was made originally for live performance, and I think works best as a live performance, and she's still doing it as a live performance. But this is Tamara Saulwick's Endings, I think an exemplary work of oral dramaturgy.
When my son was 3 years old, he came across a fly on the floor, a dead fly lying on its back. I picked it up by its little wing, opened the back door and threw it out into the winter night. My son, concerned about the welfare of the fly, asked, "Mum, why did you throw the fly out the back?" I said, "Because it was dead." "Won't it be cold?" he asked. I said, no, it won't be cold because it's dead. And I laughed. Then later, after climbing into bed, "Mum, will I feel the cold when I'm dead?" I said, "No, you won't feel the cold because, Mum, will I be able to see when I'm dead? How will I be able to speak? Where will you be, Mum? How will I find you when I'm dead?"
"Dad, your brother's coming to the room now. He's just here to see you, and we're with you, Dad. We're with you right here. Dad, your brother's coming to the room.
Listeners, if they want to, and I encourage them to, can go to Tamara Sawick's website, and you can link through to ABC Radio National to hear the full radio version of that piece, a brilliant piece of work. Yeah. Sadly, was produced on an ABC radio program that no longer exists. So to come back to what Laura was saying about the demise at an institutional level of some of the support structures for sound compositions. But artists are drawn to it in extraordinary, just huge active ways. Yeah.
That was a brilliant, brilliant piece. Lovely. So can I just say to you both, thank you for this conversation, and I hope it's going to be useful in terms of the project.
Okay. Thank you, Gay. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Gay. Yeah, thank you, Laura.
Thank you all.
You've been listening to Lend Me Your Ears, presented by Duška Radosavljević, curated by Flora Petrolo, and produced by Tim Bano. The Lend Me Your Ears podcast is part of Oral Dramaturgies, an AHRC leadership fellowship held by Duška Radosavljević at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama.